talking to me?
Funny like I'm a clown, I use you.
Here's Johnny.
He's looking at you, kid.
We're on a mission from God.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I'm going to make him an offer again with you.
Good morning. Today is August 29th. I'm Tom Stockman.
Jim Batts.
And this is Michael Hafner.
And wishing my mother a happy birthday today. It's
her birthday. Yeah.
Happy birthday, Mrs. Batts.
I was not created in a test tube or revived on a slab. All right. I have a mother.
Jim has a mother, and this is the We Are Movie Geeks podcast. And here we are. We are going to we got a bunch of movies to review, so we need to get started here in a minute. But first, let's talk about the top 12 at the box office. Number 12 was also number 12 last week, Hell or High Water. I thought it might have moved up a little bit, but apparently not. It made $3.7 billion.
Well, if we're a perfect world, it would.
Yeah.
Number 11 was Secret Life of Pets, $3.8 billion. Poor Ben Hur. Doggone it!
It barely snuck in the top 10 there.
Yeah,
it's only the second weekend.
I'm surprised it's still there in the top 10. Actually,
that's too bad. It made a paltry $4.5 million on its $100 million plus budget. Jason Bourne made $5.2 million. Bad Moms made $5.8 million. That was number 8. 7 was War Dogs. I guess that's not doing too well.
No, not at all.
I'm not surprised.
Well, I'm surprised it's that high up in the top 10. I would have thought it'd be a little closer to the bottom of the top 10. So,
I thought it's interesting that Bad Moms is the only R-rated comedy this summer that's actually gone close to 100 million.
Is that rated R?
Yeah.
Does Mila Kunis get naked?
I wish, but no.
No. Oh, yeah. You did see it. Okay, yeah.
I didn't see it. I want to see it, actually.
Not bad.
Dragon was number 6 with $7.3 million. Mechanic Resurrection, I saw that Friday night.
Oh, gosh, how was that?
That was pretty good.
They didn't screen that one for the critics. So,
It's not for critics, trust me. It's critic-proof, though. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. But I'll go into detail a little bit later. It's not as good as the first. Well, it's not as good as the remake of the first one.
I was going to say the remake's quite good with Ben Foster, correct?
Yeah. The remake is pretty good. Where were we? Oh, number 4 was Sausage Party. That's done pretty darn good.
Yeah.
The third week.
I would have thought it would have sunken down, but I think it's building word of mouth.
An R-rated animated film?
Yeah.
Making that much money?
Someone's breaking through finally with the adult animation crowd, so there you go.
Kubo and the Two Strings. I saw that Saturday night.
Speaking of animation,
I saw that Saturday night.
Claymation, you mean?
Well, puppet animation.
Yeah.
You know, we were talking last week about Brenda Vaccaro starring as the grandma. And I remember that she was nominated for an Oscar in the mid-70s. I couldn't remember what movie it was for exactly. So I looked it up, and it was for a movie called Once Is Not Enough.
Oh, yeah.
So I was at a friend of mine's house the other day, and sure enough, there was the Blu-ray of Once Is Not Enough sitting there. And I borrowed it, and I watched it over the weekend. Have you ever seen that?
Is that a Jekyll and Suzanne type of thing?
Yeah, it was Jekyll and Suzanne. It was made in 75, and it's really funny. It's this real goofy Hollywood soap opera thing with Kirk Douglas.
Is it Deborah Raffin in it?
Yeah, Deborah Raffin plays his daughter. Okay. She's really the star. Alexis Smith and Melina Mercury and David Jansen and Gary Conway. There's all these actors.
Oh,
my gosh. It's pretty cheesy.
It's like a Super Love Boat or something.
Yeah. it's kind of like Valley of the Dolls, but without the drugs and without the women.
The good stuff.
It's not that good. But I kind of enjoyed it. Deborah Raffin's quite good. I guess they were grooming her to be a big star.
Yeah,
it's been 10 years before Death Wish 3.
Sounds pretty
her
kitschy.
Masterpiece. Oh. Anyways, I totally got off track there.
Yeah, you enjoy Kubo and
the Two Strings.
Kubo and the Two Strings. Starring Brenda Vaccaro.
Yeah, she's got a pretty big part in it. Sizable.
And that made $7.9 million coming in at number 3. And Suicide Squad, number 2. Oh, it was number 1 like the past 3 weeks, and now it's number 2.
Finally knocked off.
Made a paltry $12.1 million. And the horror movie Don't Breathe was number 1. And I reviewed Don't Breathe at WeAreMovieGeeks.com. I gave it 4 out of 5 stars. So thanks to my positive review, it made $26.1 million.
Well, that and the fact that it delivers on what it promises.
Yeah. I think all of us actually like that one.
Yeah, it's a pretty good horror film. What opens this weekend? We were just talking about that. Opens this weekend.
There's so many.
But a bunch of little things open this weekend.
We got
a lot of stuff to review, but nothing big opens this week.
Well, the biggest thing, I guess, would probably be Light Between the Oceans, or the Light Between the Oceans. That's the one with Michael Fassbender.
Is that even getting a wide release, or is that going to be one of those limited, thousand screen?
I think it opens at the High Point here.
It might be just in 3 or 4 screens in town, I'm guessing. But but yeah, it's more of an art film. It's going after the Oscar buzz.
Yeah, and you saw that, right?
I did see that.
So we review that. We got a lot of stuff to review. Nightlife of Louis Drax opens this Friday. Mm-hmm. We'll be tearing and reviewing that here in a few minutes as well. All right, let's get started on these reviews, doggone it. How about let's start with Hands of Stone. Who saw? Everybody raise your hand of stone if you saw Hands of Stone over the weekend.
I've trained more world champs than anyone else in boxing history. I haven't stepped into a ring for more than a decade. In 66 seconds, Roberto Duran changed my life.
That would
just
be
Jim.
Me.
Did you review it?
Yeah, I'm all punch drunk from it still.
So. Oh, I'm sure you are.
How many stars did you give it?
I think I gave it 2 out of 5. It's pretty
really?
Deal.
It didn't deliver the knockout punch?
No, it didn't. It TKO'd me and left me down for the count. Hmm. No, it's just kind of a mess. It doesn't know if it wants to be a biography of Roberto Duran or his trainer, Ray Arcells, so they're bouncing back and forth. I think I mentioned in my review, they bring in Arcells' estranged drug addicted daughter for no real purpose. It's just kind of a mess. And one of the most important questions that I get about these boxing movies, I remember when Creed came out, my brother Jeff said, how are the boxing scenes? And that's what you got to sell
so
people
Jim, how are
on.
The boxing scenes?
Lousy. You know, Creed set a new high standard for boxing sequences in film. So, you felt
I
like
I think the Raging Bull set the high standard, which Creed didn't even come close
I think
to.
The sound
did you
design,
see Creed?
I think the sound design the sound design in Raging Bull, I think, is makes it stand out.
Well, that's true. I'm not disparaging Raging Bull, but, Creed is
so
really
good. So, Jim's on
record,
he hates Raging Bull. Go on.
No, I love Raging Bull, but.
And this,
sir, is no Raging Bull. Hands of Stone is no Raging Bull. Although some reviewer somewhere says, oh, it's in the tradition of Raging. No, not nearly. Yeah. The boxing scenes, you get in the ring, and it's these little 2 or 3 second short little clips, and then they'll cut to the audience, and then they'll cut to the corner and go back to an extreme close up, and you just get no sense of rhythm, no follow through, and they're just kind of mangled messes. The only thing that distinguishes them is they will establish where this is happening. This is in Las Vegas. This is on Olympic Stadium in Ontario. Well, it's not much. Then the main problem, one of the main problems that I mentioned, it's about Roberto Duran. His character through it, you don't quite understand his motivations a lot of the time. They show him, for instance, gorging himself on food just hours before his rematch with Sugar Ray Leonard, and his wife's trying to stop him, and you're like, why are you doing this?
Did he pour a pitcher full of ice down his pants?
No, I don't think so, but why are you sabotaging yourself like this? And it just kind of rambles on, and for some reason, the first half of it or so is narrated by Robert De Niro's character, and they have him like he's in the back of a gymnasium. It's like, what is the deal? We know he's not there in front of us talking. And, that's a cliche that went out with the 30s, So it's very, very strange.
Who directed this film?
This was directed by and written by Jonathan Jacobutz, who, this is his first English language film. Hopefully it's not going to be his last. But it's just kind of a mishmash. Usher is pretty good as Sugar Ray, but doesn't have a whole lot to do in it. John Turturro shows up a few times to be kind of menacing. It's this sort of mob connection that's telling De Niro that boxing is only for Madison Square Garden and that sort of thing. Ellen Barkin shows up for a few minutes as Ray Arcells, De Niro's wife, but she has little to do except kind of be feisty and tease him about I wish you were with another woman and spend. Instead of spending all his time at the gym and all that. But, I don't know, it just kind of goes nowhere. There's a lot of tacky 70s and 80s fashions, lots of disco shots right out of Scarface or something like that. Speaking about War Dogs, the female co-star of that, Ana de Armas is in it as Felicidad, Roberto Duran's wife. And they're supposed to meet when she's a high school girl, and Roberto's supposed to be in his late teens or so. But as a couple of my reviewer friends at the screening said, he always looks about 35. So the scenes where he's chasing her down on her way home or way to school is kind of creepy. You're wondering if he's got a van around the corner or something. So it just doesn't work. And I know that that they've been trying to promote, you know, Edgar Ramirez as the next, you know, big kind of star. And, it, you know, with this and Joy and the remake of Point Break, this it's just not happening yet. You know, he's got some good films ahead of him, hopefully. But this is not a stellar effort, I think.
Okay, so Hands of Stone, Jim doesn't recommend. And I probably won't see.
Yeah, watch Raging Bull again.
There you go.
Or Creed,
yeah.
All right, let's move on to something better. And that something better was the number one movie over the weekend, Don't Breathe.
Yo, I got our ticket out of here. Rumor is this guy is sitting on at least 300K. Boom!
That's our guy.
Wait, is he blind?
We messed up to rob a blind guy, isn't it?
Just because he's blind don't mean he's insane, bro.
Don't Breathe's a horror movie. It stars
Jane Levy,
and is directed
by the Evil Dead remake. Yeah,
yeah, that's right. Yeah. It stars the director of the Evil Dead remake, Fred Alvarez.
Mm-hmm.
But really, the star of Don't Breathe is Stephen Lang. Stephen Lang's a great character actor who I've admired for a long time. He plays this blind dude, and Miss Levy and a couple of other actors play a couple of young punks that break into his house because he's supposedly sitting on a settlement because his daughter had been killed by the daughter of some wealthy family that. I guess paid him a bunch of money not to go after, or I guess not to prosecute the daughter. I don't know. It didn't make a whole lot of sense. But they figure he'd be an easy mark since he's blind. Ha! The joke's on them. He's actually pretty psychotic himself.
And he's an Iraqi war veteran. Hence
That's right.
The reason why he's so good at taking out these teens one after another.
Yeah, I don't know where your sympathies were supposed to lie in this film, but they certainly weren't for these teens. I even said in my room, I wish there had been more of them so that we could have had them kill off a few more.
Well, you know, at being the victim of a burglary many years ago, I'm thinking, going into this movie, how am I going to sympathize with these kids? Because, you know, after that happened to me, I was like, yeah, I want to, you know, throttle these guys. But they kind of, you know, get you a little bit
a little bit.
It's still wrong, of course.
No.
But it's a really well done thriller, and I was really surprised.
Now, were you guys able to see what was going on at the Ronnies when you guys saw it?
Yeah, there
were a few scenes where I just couldn't see, and I think they did that on purpose. Of course, they were trying to replicate what a blind man would be going through.
But you referring to the basement scenes?
Yeah,
in particular?
It's just pitch black, and then you know it's illuminated a bit by some gunshots.
Yeah, I thought we'd get that green,
night vision. I'm glad that they didn't do that. Actually,
I'm happy that they avoided that. But yeah, it's great because there's one sequence with the Jane Levy character, and she's kind of stumbling around, and she's kind of inches away from, you know, touching someone she shouldn't.
Yeah,
and the audience is just going out of their mind. That's one thing we need to talk about. You really should see this in a theater with a good sized crowd because by gosh, this is a movie that made those kids put down their damned iPhones.
Oh,
and
it was
watch
great.
It.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many sequences throughout this where there's no sound design, there's no music, there's very little noise. And the whole audience was silent. You know, you get a little bit of the nervous laughter later in the film during a couple of sequences, which we don't have to go into for spoiler territory. But like many of the sequences throughout the film are extremely quiet, and the audience like felt that energy, and they you know also were quiet and in the moment, and that's so great. That's what's so great about seeing a horror film in like a theater like that.
Yeah, it reminded me of my days in college of seeing. Movies at the old great downtown Chicago State Street Theaters.
Yeah. And we haven't mentioned Cujo the Killer Rottweiler yet.
Oh, he's a
not a Rottweiler, but yeah, he's definitely.
I thought he was a Rottweiler.
Well, no, is he a Mastiff of some sort?
Oh, I thought he was
a
Rottweiler.
Is it like a mix?
I thought he was just a kind of a bulky Rottweiler, but maybe I'm wrong. I don't know.
Yeah.
Oh, he's another Cujo. Yeah. He's terrific.
Yeah, he's just as fierce as Stephen Lang is.
Yeah. The weak point for me was this fifth character that sort of appears. About halfway through the film, her participation doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Getting into spoilers.
I'm not getting into the spoilers.
You certainly are.
And if this character is who they say this character is, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense for her to be there. Wouldn't he be the you know the prime suspect in her disappearance? I didn't really buy that sort of little subplot.
I'm glad I saw it before hearing that you know stuff that you reveal in the review. That's for sure.
Yep.
Too much.
Yeah. What is great though is for the most part. I mean, Fede Alvarez does something different than what he did with Evil Dead. With Evil Dead remake, he basically kind of did what. Sam Raimi set out to do, was just make this intense, almost gore film. You know, here you get a little bit of gore, but he falls back on more of like old school sort of horror, you know, tropes where he uses silence and darkness to kind of create this tense sort of atmosphere. He doesn't rely on the gore too much like he did with Evil Dead.
Yeah, talk about the old tropes. I came coming out of it. I said, well, this is kind of turning the old film White Until Dark on its ear. That was where Audrey Hepburn was a blind woman menaced by these people.
Correct.
And it was a nice twist on that. And there's no supernatural elements in it.
No.
So this is pretty much, you know,
except when the Detroit police show up 2 minutes after the 911 call. The Detroit police wouldn't go anywhere near a neighborhood like that.
Well, maybe it's right next to the donut shop or they're in a big
perhaps.
But yeah, this is a really, really nice nice film. This is one of the best thrillers of the year, I think.
Yeah, it's been a good year for horror movies. I don't think this is the best horror movie of the year, but it's certainly above average.
Yeah.
One of the better horror movies.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think it pays off on what it promises.
All right, let's move on from a good horror film to what I've heard. I haven't seen it. It's not a particularly good horror film, and that is Morgan. Did you guys both see Morgan?
We both saw that.
Yes,
is that any good?
Yes. let you go. I'll
be reviewing it on Friday. But to me, there's been so many films that have sort of tackled the Frankenstein lore before, and so many better films have done it more successfully. It's very average, to say the least. It's very predictable. The one thing I do like about it is you've got some great character actors in it, like Toby Jones, who I've admired for so long.
Yeah.
He's really great. What's interesting is how the relationship between Morgan, who is this test tube baby in a sense, that is being breeded and is – technically, I think they say she's five. She's like a five-year-old, even though she has the body of, like, say, like an 18-year-old in the film.
She's a product, though.
Yeah. How she relates to her handlers versus her quote-unquote mother is different. You always think of, like, the test tube baby being connected with the mother, you know, which is in this film is played by Michelle Yeoh.
Yeah.
Correct?
Yeah.
Here, she has more of a relationship with her handlers. So I thought that was interesting. I like that they have this house juxtaposed with the science lab underneath it. It has this old sort of Victorian sort of farmhouse. So all of that's great, but it's just a very generic film that doesn't really do a whole lot new.
What was the one last year with Olivia Wilde and Mark Duplass?
Oh, Lazarus Effect.
Is it like that? It looks a little bit like that.
I don't think so, really. This is closer to something like Splice.
It's like a combination of Splice, and Ex Machina, but without either of the smarts of those two films.
And I don't know. I'm not hopefully revealing too much, but it starts with an incident. And what is unrealistic to me is the handlers are pretty much all on the side of Morgan, including the person in the incident. And it's just – I think that's ridiculous. I think at least one or two of them –
Who does Kate Mara play, then?
She plays a sort of a representative of the company that's funding everything.
Yeah, she's sort of a button-up government agent who has to be like the stern and silent type that's reviewing the case of the incident that Jim's talking about. And
deciding whether to shut them all down.
Yeah. All right. What's interesting, though, is how the director did choose – so she's very sort of androgynous in this sort of male outfits. And Morgan is also a very sort of androgynous sort of looking character. So how they play off one another is...
Okay, so you're going to review it, Michael, for WeAreMovieGeeks.com. How many stars did you be given?
Maybe two.
Okay. And Morgan is played by the star of The Witch, by the way.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
Huh, that goat?
Yes, no. Black Phillip. Yeah.
Okay. Black Phillip is back.
Okay, there you go. So Jim and Michael don't really recommend Morgan very much. All right, I saw... The Mechanic Resurrection.
The principal I represent has an offer for you. Each death must look like an accident. Your specialty, I believe.
Nocturnus kills.
Bishop!
The other night, they did not show it to us. Although they did have a screening, but the press was not invited. Huh. It's sitting at a whopping 25% over at Rotten Tomatoes. It's not a movie for critics, though. I kind of enjoyed it. If you like Jason Statham and his brand of action, you're going to like this movie. It's not quite as good as the remake of The Mechanic, which starred Jason Statham. The original, of course, starred Charles Bronson in 1972 and Jan Michael Vincent as this apprentice assassin. I read director of that movie was Michael Winner. I read his autobiography, and he talked about how originally Richard Dreyfuss was cast as the apprentice.
Oh, wow.
And like the day before filming, they fired Richard Dreyfuss because nobody could stand him. That was been the year before American Graffiti, I guess. The remake had Ben Foster as the apprentice, and that was, what, 3 or 4 years ago, I think. The new one doesn't have an apprentice. The new one's about Arthur Bishop, again played by Jason Statham, and you think he got killed. Well, the audience doesn't think he got killed, but everybody else thinks he got killed at the end of the first mechanic, so he's sort of hiding away somewhere. I think in
Rio. So he's resurrected now?
Yeah, he's hiding out in Rio de Janeiro, and he's living in a boarding house run by Michelle Yeoh, who you just mentioned.
Oh, yeah.
Was in some other film. She looks exactly the same as she did 15 years ago.
Yeah, she doesn't age. All that rice, and, I guess.
Michael! What was it? Crouching Tiger, yeah. That was what she started. And then when she went on the 007 movie.
Yeah, she was
a
Dynamite.
Tomorrow Never Dies.
One of those. Yeah. So she's in it, and his cover gets blown, and at the same time, he also falls in love with Jessica Alba, who also looks the same as she did 15 years ago. And she's in a bikini in a lot of shots, too, by the way. Anyways, Jessica Alba gets kidnapped, and the kidnappers, is the ransom. They tell the mechanic, Arthur Bishop, that he has to pull off three hits. He has to hit the three biggest arms dealers in the world because this arms dealer who has kidnapped Jessica Alba wants no competition. So he pulls off these three hits, and they're actually pretty exciting sequences. The first one, he goes to this prison in Thailand, and he gets himself arrested, so he gets inside this prison because this arms dealer is actually in prison, even though he's running things from his prison cell. And that's a really good sequence. And then the second one is he has to go to Australia for the second hit. And that's the hit that they show in the trailer where this guy has this big clear swimming pool sticking out of like the 60th floor of his penthouse. That's pretty good, too. And then the third arms dealer is actually played by Tommy Lee Jones. And he goes to perform a hit on him, but then they decide to team up and go after this guy who's kidnapped Jessica Alba. Tommy Lee Jones has a lot of fun in this role. He plays it as sort of this biker hippie type, and he's wearing these weird orange sunglasses, and you can tell he's just having a lot of fun. I think he knew he was an actor for hire in this sort of cheesy action film, but it's really his characterization is a lot more interesting than the one he did in Jason Bourne last month. In fact, I think this movie is a lot more interesting than Jason Bourne.
I hope it's better than the party playing criminal also.
Yeah. It's an okay movie. I mean, good grief. I don't know why you would expect to go to a Jason Statham movie like this and expect great art, but it's got great action sequences. Like I say, it's not quite as good as the remake from 3 or 4 years ago, but it's got a higher body count. Each of these guys he's supposed to hit has like a goon squad of 25 or 30 assistants that he has to plow through all of them first. Like I say, Jessica Alba looks great. Jason Statham's fine. There's really nothing wrong with this movie.
I just like the fact that he's maintaining this sort of 80s sort of action role that, you know, is sort of left vacant for a while. You know, you had Schwarzenegger and Stallone and all these people doing these films in the 80s and 90s, and no one's really making these sort of macho action films anymore.
He's been doing this for a while. And he always delivers. His movies always make a profit.
The only thing wrong with it is they didn't show it to the critics. They should, you know. I mean, you could say the same thing about horror films, but Don't Breathe showed to the critics. And we all appreciate it for what it was. And, you know, I think if they should have given it a chance.
Not everything has to be an Academy Award, you know, budding film. Yeah.
Speaking of Academy Awards, Jim, will Light Between the Oceans be nominated for any Academy Award?
Can't just be a coincidence that she showed up.
She's a lovely baby, but you can't keep her.
She needs us. We're not doing anything wrong.
That's a possibility. I think Alicia Vikander could be up again. Who knows? Michael Fassbender could get a Best Actor. This is a swooning romantic drama. It's set in Australia right after World War One. Michael Fassbender is playing this sort of psychologically scarred vet, and he decides he's going to take the job of looking over the lighthouse that sort of is in the bay area that connects the two oceans. And the previous lighthouse guy had taken a dive out of the top window or something. So they said, this guy, I think he can handle it okay. But he becomes romantically involved with a village girl who's played by Alicia Vikander. They have a quick romance. And they decide to get married because he is going to be out on the lighthouse by himself. He kind of needs an assistant, a helper, and all that. And it's very romantic. romantic. There's a lot of shots of them, you know, canoodling and, you know, cooking for each other. But they're also trying to start a family because that'll help out with the lighthouse too. And she is having a great deal of difficulty. Actually, she loses one of their kids, and you know, they think it's going to be pretty much hopeless. And then a little canoe washes up ashore, and there's a dead guy in the canoe, but there's a baby in there, and it's alive. And Alicia Vikander said, this is a sign from God that we should take care of this baby, and we're going to be a family. So they decide to lie to everybody that comes in with supplies and all that, saying that that they finally had a successful pregnancy, and this is their new child. They destroy the canoe and bury the guy on the grounds there near the lighthouse. And then when they finally have some time off and come into town to visit the new grandparents, they're at the church for the sort of confirmation baptism. They notice a woman weeping at a gravestone, and it is Rachel Weisz as Hannah.
Don't tell me she's the mother of this baby.
I think you guessed right. Yes.
Saw that coming a mile
away. I
want
to see the Mari pregnancy test.
Yeah. Is this not based on a novel?
This is based on a novel.
It sounds like something based on a novel.
Yeah, by M.L. Stedman. It's directed at a screenplay by Derek Cianfrance, who did The Place Between the Pines.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good movie. I adore.
And, as I say, if you're a fan of Fassbender and Vikander, and even Weisz, even though she doesn't show up more than an hour into the film, I think you'll be fairly pleased with it. It's a little slow-moving at times, but the atmosphere is great. Jack Thompson and Brian Brown show up. I guess they're Australian, Hall of Famers when it comes to movies and all that. So
you're going to review this?
I think that's going to be Kate reviewing it. Yeah.
Okay. If you were to review it, how many stars would you give?
I'd probably give it 3 at least. Yeah, maybe a little more, 3.25 or something.
All right. How about a real quick review of Equity? What the heck is Equity?
Equity is an investment thriller. There, you know, while The Big Short was sort of a comedy about Wall Street. This is more along the lines of a thriller. It's what turns it on its ear. It's written by women, and the main protagonist is a woman.
Oh yeah,
and she's played by Anna Gunn, who was known as the woman from Breaking Bad. She's got kind of a fan base from that, and she's trying to spearhead offering a public stock in a company called Cachet. And it's like one of these social network websites, but it's got super security, so you can post anything and everything you want on there, if you know what I mean. And the thing is, Anna Gunn is Naomi. Her last IPO offering, their public offering, it tanked, and so a lot is writing on this because she's had a lot of successful one, but you're like with Hollywood, you're only known by your last project. And she's got a boyfriend on the side that works at the bank also, but he's in investments, and he's trying to find information about sort of insider trading type
stuff. Let's cut to the chase, Jim. I'm sorry. We've got...
Yeah, certainly. It's not as interesting as Mechanic. I'm sorry.
I'm sure it's not. Is this movie any good?
It's okay. I think it's a noble effort. I think it kind of falls apart at the end, but it's kind of interesting. And I'm always concerned with these Wall Street things. I won't be able to figure out what's going on, but I was able to follow it pretty much from beginning to end. So I would, if I were reviewing it, I would probably give it 3.5 stars.
Okay, and Raiders, the Story of the Greatest Fan Film, continues this weekend over at Webster University.
Yeah.
You saw it last night.
Yes.
Yes.
Saturday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday next week, and it's worth checking out. It's sort of a love letter to independent or low budget filmmaking. It's about these two guys that are adults right now, but they were around 10 or 11 in 1982, and they loved Raiders of the Lost Ark so much that they said, we're going to recreate the whole thing on home video, and they
did it almost like shot by shot.
Even though, you know, there wasn't available on videotape at the time, Raiders wasn't, so they had to kind of memorize the movie from seeing it in the theaters. And it's so funny, they're all shot in their basement and all these weird locations. They were able to do pretty much every sequence from Raiders except for the big flying wing sequence. If you recall, that's the one in which Indy fights this towering bald German as the flying wing is over them. And they've decided at the start of this movie that they're going to complete the film, even though they're in their late 30s, 40s, or whatever. They're going to bring the gang back together, and they're going to do a Kickstarter thing, get investors, and finish this sequence. And that's the main thrust of the film, that and the making of this film during the 1980s. I think they shot shot most of it from 1982 through 1989, all during their summer vacations and breaks and all that. And it's charming. You know, it's a real sort of an underdog story. And it's very, very entertaining. At the end of it, during the end credits, I'm not giving a whole lot away, they do a shot-by-shot, side-by-side bit with the original Raiders and their recreation of this scene. So that's very entertaining. Yeah,
but, and then they show the recreation movie.
Yeah, adaptation, they call it. Yeah, the Raiders of the Lost Ark adaptation.
Afterwards. So if you go to Webster, you'll see this documentary about the making of it. And then is that first?
The making of it is first.
And then you'll see the actual film that they made.
Yeah, they've told, they have a little posting there. So if you've had enough Raiders, come by in the evening and we'll just watch adaptation for free or whatever. So that's, you know, pretty much, you can just pop in and see that. So yeah, it's a sweet little film. It's very entertaining. I give it 4 stars by reviewing it.
Okay, sweet little film, says Jim. Another sweet little film is Little Men. Ooh.
The genesis of acting is seeing, understanding what makes behavior.
I did it again.
I did it again.
You did it again.
You did it.
You
again.
Did it.
You.
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 You did it.
You did it.
You did it.
I didn't do it.
Get out of my face.
Get out of my face.
Get out of my
get
face.
Out of my
get out of my face. Face. Get out of my face.
Little Men opens Friday. It stars Greg Kinnear and Jennifer L. as a couple who move from they move from Manhattan to Brooklyn or Brooklyn to Manhattan. I can't remember.
To Brooklyn, yes.
Okay, and because his father has died and has left him a building.
Yeah.
And they're going to move into this building, but there's this family living in living in the building.
They're not living in the building. They manage a dress shop.
That's right. That's right. They have some sort of seamstress shop in the first floor of the building, and they're I think Guatemalan immigrants or Chilean immigrants or something like that.
Leonor is the woman's name.
And Greg Kinnear's father has been renting this first floor to them for many, many years at a way below market rent. And that seems to be pretty much the whole conflict of this movie is that, not the whole conflict, but that Greg Kinnear wants to raise their rent, which they can't afford. In the meantime, that family has a young son, and he has a young son, and these two boys become best friends, and it's sort of a coming of age movie, but it's also about the gentrification of New York. But it's only 85 minutes long, which is kind of weird.
It's a little film.
It's a slight film, and it's sort of a modest film. But it has some strengths. Greg Kinnear is just really one of my favorite actors, even though he tends to make mediocre films. There's something really relatable about him. I'm always sort of comforted when I see him up on the screen. I really, really like Greg Kinnear, and he's great in this film.
And the real selling point of this film, I think, is the relationship between these two boys. It's very interesting. Greg Kinnear's son, Jake, is kind of shy, kind of soft. He's a little introverted, and he's into doing artwork. And this other boy, this Tony, he's really outgoing. He wants to be an actor. He's sort of a motor mouth. And it's interesting how these two guys connect that you wouldn't think would connect. Mm. And you're kind of rooting for this friendship to survive the battle going on between their parents. What's odd to me, Tom, I don't know if it was the case with you, but Leonor, the woman that's got the dress shop, is so antagonistic towards
Paulina
Greg Kinnear's character.
Yeah.
You know, when she's putting him off about discussing the rent, and when they finally get together to talk about it, all she does is batter him about the fact that his father didn't like him and didn't approve of his being an actor and that his wife is the breadwinner.
Yeah.
And you'd think she'd be being nice to him.
Yeah. Well, she offers him 10% off some seamstress fees,
But she says, the store's...
He's got to get his pants hemmed. Yeah, 10% off that.
But, the store is not doing well, and he comes by, and she's got a help wanted sign on the door of the building. He's
there's some weaknesses to this film. It's only 85 minutes long, but it at the same time, it still feels kind of padded. There's a scene where the two teenage boys go to this, I guess, some sort of acting camp or something, and there's a scene that just goes on and on and on with this acting teacher that was so stupid.
I thought it was kind of sweet.
Then I watched the trailer, and they show that scene during the trailer for a long, long time. I didn't really understand that. It's like I say, it's sort of slight and modest. I do recommend it though. It's pretty good. It's well written and it's well acted. But if you go to a lot of movies, go out and see it. But if you don't see if you only see one movie a month,
be one of those like quirky sort of Little Miss Sunshine
more like Squid in the Whale, more serious.
Yeah, this is by the director of Love Is Strange. If you saw that one about John Lithgow and Alfred Molina has a cameo in it.
Yeah,
he's not a big star on it, but he
speaks English.
But he does speak English, but he's only got a couple of scenes in it, so don't go looking for him. But yeah, the acting is real strong. And these two young actors, Theo Tablets and Michael Barbieri, I hope to see them again in the future. I thought they were very good in it.
All right, so are you reviewing this for Weird Movie Geeks, Jim?
I don't know if it's me or Kate. I guess we'll see. But if I were reviewing, I'd give it 4 stars.
I'd probably give it 3.5. All right, let's move on. We're going to save the best for last. The most misguided, overdirected, poorly acted, pretentious movie of 2016 so far, The Ninth Life of Louis Drax.
The patient's name is Louis Drax, 9 years old. He fell off one of the cliffs at Land's End.
He was dead for 2 hours. I've never seen anything like it. He's in a coma. But he's alive.
So who's the audience for this film? That was like one of my biggest things once I got into the middle of this film. Is like, what was this film made for? Like, who was this made for?
Yeah, Michael, when it started, it looked like it was trying to be a Roald Dahl adaptation didn't it?
Yeah, well, what I read is that this was a movie that Anthony Mangella, who won the Oscar for directing The English Patient, this was a movie he had been preparing when he died. He was going to direct this, and his son Max Mangella actually adapted the screenplay from this book. Maybe if Anthony Mangella had directed, he might have made some more sense out of this thing. But it's directed by Alexander Aja, who's really best known for some horror films that he did a decade or so ago. Some really good horror films, including
High Tension,
Piranha 3D,
The House of Eyes remake.
Yeah, yeah. And The Mirrors, which isn't quite so good.
Yeah, we won't mention that film. It's awful.
What was the one a couple years ago? Horns.
Horns, which is also
that's
a misguided adaptation as well.
Yeah. But this movie's really ridiculous. It has some of the worst acting I've ever seen. Jamie Dornan, who we kind of expect to give us bad performances after 50 Shades of Grey, plays this doctor who's treating this little boy who has fallen into a coma after falling off of a cliff. And his father disappears. Everybody thinks his father pushed him off the cliff. His mother's played by Sarah Gadone, who... she's just terrible too. She just furrows her brow and talks in the same tone of voice throughout the entire thing.
And Aja dresses her up in all these 50s June Cleaver dresses and whatnot throughout the film.
And then you got Oliver Platt playing the exact same character he has played at least 500 times. Then you got Molly Parker as the horribly inappropriate detective who approaches Jamie Dornan and says, "Are you screwing her?" Although he doesn't.
I don't think she doesn't say screwing, but
And you didn't mention Aaron Paul, who had great success on TV and Breaking
Bad.
He's
actually pretty good. I think he's the one who sort of escapes with his dignity.
Isn't going to make him a film star. Oh. He's not there yet, you know.
No, but the worst is Aidan Longword as little Louis Drax. He's the kid who falls off the cliff. He is the most obnoxious child performer, the most precocious kid. I wanted to knock him off a cliff myself, or at least knock him down and stomp on his neck. He acts like a kid in a TV commercial for some sugary cereal or something. I don't know where they found this kid, but they need to send him back. We need to get some more subtle performances from kids. They're always bad in these movies. I don't know what genre this is supposed to be.
Maybe an adult fairy tale, sort of like a Guillermo del Toro.
Yeah, I don't know.
They were going for that, but they had this really poorly designed monster that shows up in some dream sequences.
Yeah, and I want to defend the young actor a little bit. I don't think any young actor could have pulled this script off. This is just a terrible script.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah, and pretty poor direction too.
Well, and I don't know about you guys, but to me, I was getting a little bit of like a Brian De Palma sort of vibe in the sense that like all the adults are adulterous and having affairs. Yeah. All of you know, you have the psychiatrist like you have in a lot of the De Palma films. You have this twist ending at the end, which I won't get into, but it's something straight out of De Palma.
You've also got this overbearing score, which. You'll hear in De Palma films, but it doesn't work. And this one's this tinkly, weird piano score.
Yeah,
it's
I
just
don't
awful.
Know.
You're talking about like a Dress to Kill vibe, kind of?
A little bit of Dress to Kill, a little bit of Raising Cain.
I could see that, but...
Boy,
what a stinker.
Maybe
De Palma should have directed
it. It just goes on and on. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
And you see the ending telegraphed about it, about 20 minutes before it finally mercifully ends.
Brother. So, I mean, it's transcendent in its awfulness.
It's easily
like
one of the worst films of the year.
Easily one of the worst films ever. Yeah. It kind of reminded me of a incredibly loud and extremely close. It's sort of a train wreck, awful movie, kind of like that, or Moonrise Kingdom, or... But it's not like, The Happening, which is a movie that's really, really awful, too, but I kind of enjoy watching that one. I hope to never see the ninth life of Louis Drax again. And tonight, you guys are seeing Sully.
Correct.
Yes. From director Clint Eastwood.
And it's about that monster from Monsters Incorporated. It's a
right.
solo film, right?
That's right, yeah.
Isn't that right, Jim?
Before he got his fur, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I signed up for.
Yeah. No, it's got Tom Hanks, and he's a pilot whose plane gets hijacked by some Somali pirates, I believe.
Oh, yes. He's the captain now, right?
That's right, yes.
No, I can't go, but I guess we'll be back. Actually, we won't be back next week. We'll be back in 2 weeks, and we'll review Sully, and we'll have some other stuff to review. There's a bunch of local stuff going on. I guess we'll have to cover both weekends at the Tivoli. This weekend is Princess Mononoke, which is one of these Miyazaki movies that always packs them in at the Tivoli. We always have a Miyazaki on every schedule because, you know, it's attendance insurance.
Yeah, that's some money there.
And then next weekend, which is September 9th and 10th, is The Big Lebowski. Always a lot of fun.
Princess Mononoke, I think, was just in the top 25 films of the 21st century. I think BBC
wasn't on our list.
No.
But they did like a list of 100 films, and I think it was in the top 25.
Huh. There you go.
Uh-huh. I've never seen it.
Yeah, I've seen it.
It's worth a watch.
It's beautiful, of course.
It's stunning.
Okay, so let's see. What else is going on locally? Oh, Four Color Eulogy. That's the movie by Wyatt Weed and written by Jason Contini. That is this Thursday night over at Schlafly Bottle Works, starting at 7 o'clock. It is a fundraiser for Helping Kids Together. And I know Wyatt and the producer, Gail Gallagher, will be there too.
Tuesday night at the Heavy Anchor, they're doing the Movie Interrupted with Maximum Overdrive. It's where they have a couple of different comics come in and talk over some of the films.
We saw them do that once.
Sounds like fun with that movie. That
do some Roy Rogers movie.
They were kind of doing an ongoing thing where they were kind of making up the dialogue for the film. But here, you're watching the film itself, but it's actually, they stop it and then the comics comment about what's going on so far,
I don't know if they stop it or not. Maybe they do.
Well, sounds like fun. That movie is ripe for you.
Yeah. That's a fun one. All right. And my 16mm show, 16mm double feature night next Tuesday is September 6th, and I will be showing, Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry. You ever seen that one, Mike?
Great pick. I love it.
Yeah, it's one of the great car chase movies from the mid-70s.
That helicopter scene with the car is amazing.
Yep. And that will be double feature with the 4D Man. You ever seen that one?
I haven't seen that one.
That's a science fiction movie from 1959 starring Robert Lansing and Lee Merriweather. It's pretty good, pretty colorful movie, although this is a black and white print of a color movie. And since we're not doing a show next week, I can announce right here on the We Are Movie Geeks podcast what next month's 16mm double feature is. That will be Tuesday, October 4th, starting at 8 o'clock. And since it's October, we have to do a horror film, and Roger's got a print of The Entity.
Oh, with Barbara Hershey?
Yeah, Barbara Hershey gets molested by a demon. I never saw that at the theater. I remember running it on VHS and liking it. It's a pretty scary movie, and she's really good in it.
Yeah, she gives a really intense performance.
Yeah. So that is at 8 o'clock, and that movie is 2 hours and 10 minutes, which kind of surprised me.
Wow.
So we had to try to find a short movie to play afterwards, and there's nothing shorter than the 1938 Western The Terror of Tiny Town.
Which runs
about an hour. And Jim, what is unique about The Terror of Tiny Town?
It has, this is politically incorrect now, but back then it boasted having an all-midget cast.
That's right. So it's got an all-midget cast. I think Billy Curtis is in it, and probably a bunch of people who played Munchkins and The Wizard of Oz.
Billy Barry. Probably the guy from St. Louis here, Mickey Carroll, think?
Yeah. He might be. I'm not sure. I'd have to look
Didn't
at the...
Did he pass away recently?
About 5-6 years ago, something like that.
So that's going to be a lot of fun. The Terror of Tiny Town.
Yeah, that sounds like a great lineup.
It's pretty cheesy. In fact, I think I read that they couldn't find enough midgets, so they actually put children in. Some of the background midgets are actually children that are dressed up as cowboys.
So what is the terror in the film?
I don't remember.
Billy Curtis plays the terror.
I
he's
saw
the hero
it
of the
when
film.
I was in college once in 16mm.
Yeah, and that first compilation, the 50 worst films of all time. Of course,
yeah, it was in there.
The Medveds put that in there.
I gotcha.
So that is October 4th at the Way Out Club, which is at 2525 Jefferson. The Entity and Terror of Tiny Town. The Fathom events. I saw a Fathom event last week. Oh, I saw Mothra with the Riff Tracks guys making fun of it. It was cool seeing Mothra in an HD print on the big screen, though. I love Mothra. It seems like it's really one of the more beautiful and poetic of the kaijus from Toho. There was a lot more goofy ones they could have made fun of. I'm not sure why they picked Mothra, but it was a lot of fun. Anyways, this week Fathom event. September 1st is Rob Zombie's new horror film, which is called 31.
Now, you may think you see a grease-painted performer sitting before you, but trust me, I'm not here to brighten your dismal day. I am here to end your miserable life.
What do we know about 31? Is it about clowns or something?
As far as I know, I think it's a group of kids that are kidnapped maybe on Halloween night, and they're thrown into a fun house of horrors where they're, you know, hunted down one by one by different gangs or people, and you have to it's like a competition of sorts where you have to survive the game.
Aren't clowns involved somehow?
Like all of his films.
There's an Eli Roth film coming up called Clown.
That came out on DVD last week. But
Clown. Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah. But yeah, there is some evil clowns in here, and Sherry Moon Zombie, of course, is back again, like in all of his films, wife.
She's the Jill Arlen of horror.
I'm sure Sid Haig and maybe Bill Moseley might make
a cameo.
I
don't think they're in it. I could be wrong, but I don't think either of them are in it. I know Malcolm McDowell is in it.
Yes, he is in it. Oh. He plays sort of like a Victorian creepy looking guy with this powdered wig and face paint, and it looks like a typical sort of Rob Zombie film, sort of the ugly aesthetic mixed with his shock and gore.
Elizabeth Daly is in it. She was, of course, Dottie in Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Oh yeah,
that's right. A lot of voiceover work.
Daniel Roebuck, he's in it.
He's
a big horror fan.
He is. He's actually a big collector of vintage horror monster toys. I've met.
I was going to say, doesn't he collect masks too?
He does. Ginger Lynn, one of my favorite stars.
Oh my goodness.
Judy Geeson, she dates back to
Hammer stuff,
Tracy Walter, familiar character actor. Lou Temple, he was in Devil's Rejects. I'm looking at the cast.
Yeah, Tracy Walter was the Joker's number one man in the Nicholson.
Always seems to gather these old actresses like Meg Foster.
She's in it. Apparently she has a pretty big part.
Yeah, he always has a tendency. Dee Wallace,
So that's part of the Fathom events. That's 7 o'clock this Thursday. And that's probably the only chance you're going to get to see that on the big screen. I think it's coming out straight to Blu-ray in October.
No, I think it's actually getting a limited theatrical release, but it's not till like September 16th or something. It's not for a couple of weeks, so I'm not sure if St. Louis is going to get it or not.
I know they're doing something similar with Kevin Smith's movie, Yoga Hosers.
Yoga Hosers is coming up, and they just announced today a Fathom event for Snowden. September 14th, 2 days before Snowden comes out, they're doing a Fathom event, and St. Louis is one of the cities. I saw the list today. And after the film, which the film is 2 hours, 15 minutes, they're doing a 45-minute interview with Oliver Stone and Edward Snowden in Russia. I guess Oliver Stone flew out there so that he could do this interview with Edward Snowden, because Edward Snowden can't enter the U.S. right now.
That'd be interesting.
Who is this Rob Zombie guy anyway? I mean, this guy, we did our top 21 movies of the 21st century list last month, and there were very few horror films on it, although I guess you could argue Mulholland Drive certainly is directed like a horror film. And that was number one. I think Lynn had 28 Days Later on her list. Mm-hmm. I know Ian had Cabin in the Woods on his list. And I had Rob Zombie's The Devil's Rejects on my list. I think it was number 7 or 8. It's kind of weird the way Rob Zombie just came out of the blue and became this sort of visionary horror filmmaker. I guess in 2003 when his shockingly good House of a Thousand Corpses came out. Do you know much about Rob Zombie? I know he was some kind of rock and roller guy.
Yeah, he was the front man for a band in the 90s, late 90s, mid to late 90s, called White Zombie. And from there, I think he directed some of his own.
Was that like heavy metal?
It was sort of like a heavy metal. I mean, at that time, you also had like bands like Metallica and Megadeth and Pantera, and those are really more like heavy metal. But this was a pretty heavy music by most standards.
The Misfits, is that one of
them? That was a little bit earlier, but But White Zombie, you know, their music videos incorporated a lot of these old black and white horror films, or the stuff that you would see late at night on, you know, Channel 11, you know, these old sort of B movies. And so I think that aesthetic that they incorporated in their live shows with the video projections and also in their music videos was just a natural segue for him to directing his own films.
And he came out with House of a Thousand Corpses. Like I said, I was just startled how good that was. And then 2 years later, he came out with The Devil's Rejects, which I was just totally blown away by. And then he did one of the fake trailers in Werewolf Women of the SS, or Grindhouse.
Yeah, Grindhouse.
Yeah. Is that the one that Nick Cage as Fu Manchu?
Yeah.
He sort of emerged around the same time as like Eli Roth and Alexander Ajo. You know, there was this group, and the Saul director, Darren Lynn Bozeman, where they were nicknamed sort of the Splat Pack. I don't know if you remember, but it's like there was articles about the new face of horror, the Splat Pack, and you had James Wan, and you had Darren Lynn Bozeman, you had Eli Roth, and Rob Zombie, you know, because all of them, you know, emerged from Lionsgate. Lionsgate at this time released House of a Thousand Corpses and the Saw films and High Tension.
Yeah, so. And Zombie's known for some sort of fun retro casting in his films, too, kind of like Tarantino a bit. He had Karen Black in House of a Thousand Corpses, although I guess she wouldn't come back for the sequel.
I think that's
Leslie Easterbrook. I think was the actress who played Mama Firefly. And
where does Leslie Easterbrook come from?
I don't know.
The Police Academy film.
Okay,
Okay. Well, Devil's Rejects got an amazing script. And there's that amazing scene where the guy shows. They bring in the movie buff. Remember that to help solve the crime.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Because
of Groucho Marx.
Yeah. Because
Captain Spaulding.
Right. Yeah. He uses several names. Aliases, and they're all characters that Groucho Marx had played. So they bring in this Groucho Marx expert, and they're interrogating him, and they say something like, "Oh, we should bring this Groucho Marx guy in for questioning." And I think they say, "Isn't he dead?" And then this guy goes off on this monologue about how Elvis died 2 days before Groucho Marx did, so nobody remembers Groucho Marx dying.
They're all here, all the aliases. Rufus Firefly, Otis Driftwood, Captain Spaulding, all of them.
Hey, Chief, I'm thinking we ought to track down this Groucho Marx guy. Ask him a few questions. Maybe he's involved.
Idiot. He died last year. He died, didn't he?
Oh, God damn it. See, that right there is one sad, pathetic state of cinematic affairs. If you weren't a cop, I'd wring your neck.
Hey.
Excuse me! This sneering, rotating, gyrating pelvis son of a bitch! He died 3 days before Groucho stole all the goddamn headlines.
Rob Zombie has talked about for years in interviews how he's wanted to do a Groucho Marx biopic from Groucho Marx late in his life, in the last couple of days, but also looking back at his career too. So I don't know if that's ever going to get off the ground.
I hope so. Yeah. I'd see that in a heartbeat.
Yeah, you betcha. All the stuff with Aaron Fleming and all that'd be great. Yeah.
No, then he remade Halloween.
Yeah.
In 2007, which actually started out like a more of a Rob Zombie movie. It had all these, you know, the earlier sequences with this sort of white trash family. But then about a half hour in, it just kind of turned into a Halloween movie, and I didn't think it was really up to his earlier films. Do you like the Halloween movies there, Michael?
The first two parts are interesting. So, the first part of the film, like you said, you have the white trash family. Then the second part is all in the Smith's Grove, where you have the transition between the young Michael to the older Michael. And I think that second part's really interesting because you get these great scenes with Malcolm McDowell talking to the kid as Dr. Loomis. And then, like you said, part three of that film is essentially just a remake of the original Halloween, which it just feels inferior.
And I felt Halloween 2 was pretty much more the same.
Halloween 2 is really bizarre. I don't know if either of you guys have seen it, back and rewatched it, but there's a white horse in it. There's a clear coffin. There's some really weird dream sequences throughout the film, and he plays around and gets a little bit more experimental and doesn't just remake Halloween 2.
Maybe I should see it again.
And wasn't Sybil Danning in that Halloween remake too? Everyone, she was in that werewolf trailer.
Yeah, there was a lot of, like you say, a little retro casting. And then he did The Lords of Salem. I think you and I saw Lords of Salem.
Yeah, we did.
We had to drive way the heck out to the St. Louis Mills because it was only showing at one theater for 1 week. And that's a pretty interesting movie. What do we think of this Sherry Moon Zombie? She seems to be at the center of that film. I thought she was really good in The Devil's Rejects. It was a smaller part. She was
at
the center of Lords of Salem. And she's okay. And then apparently she's at the center of the new one, 31.
She's not very she doesn't have a strong character in Lords of Salem. So she's sort of just this waifish, sort of despondent blonde DJ. And it doesn't create a dynamic film because she's just so lethargic and just doesn't really do much in the film. But like you said, she's just a ball of energy in House of a Thousand Corpses and Devil's Rejects.
Yeah, she's great. All right, well, so we're going to go see 31.
Are you looking forward to it?
Oh, yeah, of course. I'm really looking forward to it. It looks great, from judging by the trailer. But I don't know. We'll be back. We won't be back next week because, doggone it, it's Labor Day, and we're going to take take a week off, but we'll be back in 2 weeks, and I guess we'll be able to review 31, and we'll be able to review Sully, and what else? Anything else we're seeing?
Well, I'd like to say we've got this new Rachel Weisz film we can maybe talk about then.
And Snowden comes out September 16th.
Maybe we'll have seen that by then, too.
I mean, Oliver Stone, I mean, he's made a couple bad films, book, but I like many of his films, I'm intrigued by that.
And then, Jim, you wanted to pay tribute to a character actor who died over the weekend?
I should mention, though, that the movie I talked about last week, Our Little Sister, actually opens this Friday the 2nd, so that's a change.
So go back
and
listen to the podcast from last week again. Jim, 45 seconds on this character actor who died. What was his
the
name?
Wonderful Marvin Kaplan passed away the other day at age 89. He was mostly known for his television work. He was a semi-regular on the sitcom Alice. He was the voice of one of Top Cat's Choo Choo. But to movie fans, he will always be known for that memorable scene in It's a Mad World, in which he and Arnold Stang defend their brand new gas station against Jonathan Winters, and it's a classic scene. Yeah. And I guess with him gone, we've just got Carl Reiner and Barry Chase left from that great film. Right. So
R.I.P. to, say his name again,
Marvin Kaplan.
Marvin Kaplan, one of those faces you recognize, but you probably won't be able to place a name to it. So.
Original Nutty Professor, Rachel Francis, great stuff.
R.I.P. So we gotta sign off, though, for now. I'm Tom Stockman.
Jim Batts.
And this is Michael Hafner.
And thanks for joining us, Michael. Listen again in 2 weeks.
Black leather, rock. Black leather, ta-ta-ta. Black leather.
Oh, nutty state. Hello, darling.